Greetings, podcast listeners. Welcome to the December edition of Colorado Review's podcast. My name is Daniel Schoening.
And I'm Evan Senny.
And with us today is Susanna Lodge-Riegel, associate editor here at Colorado Review and an MFA candidate in poetry.
Hi, I'm happy to be here today.
Today we'll be talking about 2018's fall-winter edition of Colorado Review, including an excerpt of an essay by Erica Berry, poems by Tanya Gray and Chloe Leisure, and an excerpt of a short story by Michelle Ross.
To start, we'd like to talk about On Worry by Erica Berry, and Susanna is going to read an excerpt.
One, my father's worry. He used to hike with us to tall places and then, at the top, step and retreat from the big nothing below. Once, on a sunny rock spire in Utah, he couldn't do it. You guys look, he said, I'll wait here. Later in the city, he would show caution crossing streets to show us that we should show caution crossing streets. Both ways, he would shout, if I tipped off the sidewalk too soon. I would feel the barb of worry in his voice, and then I would see the splat of my body on the ground, just the way he saw it. Two. A few years ago, my parents spit in two plastic tubes and put them in the mail. Months later, they received two reports detailing proclivities for large toes, light sleep, and, on my mother's side, some distant connection with Susan Sarandon. Later, comparing their genetic matter like two children with a stack of baseball cards, they discovered they each carried a variation of the gene BDNF, dubbed the rumination gene by the Yale scientists who discovered it. BDNF is active in the hippocampus, that chunk of brain involved in thought and memory, and it's a gene known to inspire chronic negative stewing. Colloquially, and somewhat controversially, it's often called the worry gene. My parents were quick to report the discovery to me, and then they were quick to laugh it off. Later, researching online, I realized their reaction seemed right on point. Psychologist Robert L. Leahy from the American Institute for Cognitive Therapy advises genetic carriers of BDNF to reserve 20 minutes a day to worry and then to practice setting it aside. Three. Psychoanalyst Adam Phillips defines worry as an ironic form of hope. When we worry, we anticipate a future we cannot know. Worrying in this way is a form of preparation. It is a dress rehearsal for misery. It is also a fantasy. Like imagining the kiss of a new lover, it can be an addiction in itself. Four. Once my little thumb fell against the hot lip of my mother's cast iron pan, and the heat turned my skin to a hard pink pearl. When I went to touch the bump, my mother said, stop, and pointed me to the cold drool of the faucet. You shouldn't worry the burn, she said. As if, I thought, as if those dead cells were concerned. Like hitting the dead key on a piano, I could not stop touching it. So I worried that burn like a bead on a rosary. I did this because I knew the skin would heal. The burn, in other words, did not worry me back.
How lovely. Susanna, what made you choose this essay of our selection in Colorado Review?
I chose this piece because it feels like an especially generous and generative exploration of worry that made me think about this feeling, one that I experience often and many other people experience often, in an entirely different light. As somebody who writes about anxiety and worry in my own work, this piece felt deeply heartening and inspiring in my life and in my writing and felt like a worthwhile piece to read and discuss on this podcast.
Agreed.
At the end of that selection that Susanna read, there's a definition of worry, and those actually come up a number of times throughout the piece, and they change. And Susanna, I was wondering what you thought. Did you think that that as a craft move was effective, and what did you think that that was doing in the piece?
I am going to answer your question in sort of a roundabout way, so I'm sorry about that. But I think that Berry is really deft at taking this abstract idea of feeling And locating it within its very definition, as you mentioned, within her own condition, within history, within the scientific and the biological, and in that way illuminating it for her audience without resolving it, which feels very productive to something like worry, which has its place, even while it is certainly not something that anybody loves living with.
Mm. I like to think about the ways in which the essay as a form or those craft elements that are fundamental to one's essaying are themselves a kind of recursive worrying, that the ways by which she uses definition in this piece might be indicative of Barry's commentary on the larger craft, that just like our understanding of a given subject is changed by the multitude of ways by which we access it, by kind of the recursivity of retreading it and reimagining it in the form of that essaying. I think it is worthwhile in this piece, but also speaks to like the larger movements of the creative nonfiction generally. And I think this is a wonderful evidence of what contemporary writers in the field can do, as you said, so deftly with the tools that they have at hand.
Yeah, and in this case, in particular, it seemed like I didn't know this until reading the piece, but worry has a number of definitions and has changed over time. And one thing it seemed to allow was for the violence that worry can inflict on a person and on their life to be enacted through those definitions and the way the definitions changed. And I thought for me that was quite striking.
I also think that moment where she's talking about touching that burn on her finger and worrying the burn in that way by revisiting it and thumbing it over and again, I feel like that anecdote provides such an interesting point of access into the structure of the essay, like you mentioned, Danny, this idea of revisiting something time and time again, and perhaps in that revisiting, inflicting some violence in the change that occurs there, but also in that effort, illuminating something new each time.
Hmm. And that paragraph, I think, is really a lovely one, and I think it does that as well as highlighting something that came up for me a bunch in this piece, which was that the imagined horror is the crux of worry, and that the burn was not able to worry her back. There was actually some comfort in a thing that had already gone wrong.
I think one thing that Barry does in this essay that I admire so much and I'd like to implement more regularly in my own poetics is how carefully she makes these associative leaps within the paragraphs and between the sections, such that the personal condition of the speaker is always turning outward toward these really wonderful and beautiful contextual clues and insights. And that is something that I feel that I would love to explore further in my own poems.
Now, from the poetry section of our fall-winter 2018 edition of Colorado Review, I'll be reading Tanya Gray's Portrait of a Clarion. For those listening at home without the poem in front of them, I highly recommend setting eyes on it, as the formal life of the poem on the page really does enhance the experience for the reader. Portrait of a Clarion. The night before Joyce died, I dreamed she passed over my bedroom, hours south of her own bed, nimbus flying with orchestral arms, and prone the coal-tressed starling of her 20s, a sylph, vocalizing a hurricane squall, throwing doors wide. She was no longer my grandmother in a housecoat, wrestling sleep, grinding her teeth down to buds. Metastasis, mocking her marrow. She was a terrible sight. One-breasted and winged, a seraph in victory. The dirge, the descent, in the phonograph of my ear. Billie Holiday singing, "Angels have no thought of ever returning you." She willed to hear. I wasn't what she willed to hear. I wasn't waking, but somehow in fugue, watching her, watch me. I woke falling, the wrenching jolt, the flutter of her, no longer there, wrinkled under the wake and stranglehold of that 23rd May, when the call came, no answer, just.
I was wondering, as you read this piece, I can see it on the page, and it forms roughly three columns. And I thought that that was visually very interesting, and my eye was drawn to the columns. Is that a formal move in poetry? And I'd be interested to know what effect that's supposed to have, because for me it was very compelling.
Lots of poems, depending on the formal choices of the poet, enact what's called vertical reading as well as horizontal. Horizontals are typical left-to-right experience of reading the written word in English, and vertical reading is a mechanism by which that primary experience is complemented by one that is secondary, that is tertiary, that allows for words to exist in constellation to one another, such that either syntactically they make sensible sentences through other combinations of sections, or simply the constellation of their ideas, of those images put spatially on the page, offer further readings than the primary one that's allowed by left-to-right sentence structures. And so one of the things that Portrait of a Clarion does beautifully is demand that the reader experience the work in a multitude of lenses through a multitude of directions. Though my reading just now was the primary one, I think that's a further reason for someone to pick up the poem and see it for themselves, is that that very much is a possibility within this work.
One thing that I find so stunning about this piece is the way that the caesuras within the line set up an expectation for fracture, but also for return as the line continues. And I think that this formal choice throughout the poem really raises the stakes for the poem's conclusion, in that when we get that line, no answer just, followed by silence, the fracture sustains in a way that I find absolutely stunning and really heartbreaking.
The next piece I'll read from our poetry section is by poet Chloe Leisure. Chloe is a former graduate of the MFA program here at CSU. She was Fort Collins's 2014 Poet Laureate, and we were lucky enough to have her earlier this semester give a reading for our campus. And she's a tremendous poet, as you'll soon hear. The piece I'll be reading by her is entitled, "The Whole Shebang." Be patient. Be like the others. Be suntanned and loosey-goosey. Be your old body. Climb trees and trudge sledding hills. Be as strong as she expects you to be. Be as strong as her body, sleeping on a makeshift hospital floor. Be a cockroach. Be around after the bombs. Be all of your molecules. Be Cleopatra and King Leopold and Woolly Mammoth. Be asp. Be genocide. Be tusk. Be cocoa butter and raw honey. Be virus and salt cave. Set yourself out to dry. You're born with only so many tears and eggs and second chances. Be the golden hour among cattails and birdsong. Be scissors, scalpel. Be disarticulated, reassembled. Be corpse, be exquisite. Be cobalt, goblin of the mines. Be death, the destroyer. Be canary, diamonds on the soles of her bloody shoes. Be the sound of a cloud of migrating butterflies. Be all that you can be. Leave your mind and your heart in the hurt locker, and eat the key and all the green lion's toothy leaves. Virus your way through the village until the dirt calls you back home, until hooves and drums and aching muscles beg, enough is enough. Be nitrogen, be potatoes, be suffocation, be terror. be your future body. Be worship, be grub, be a river glittering with mica. Be the sound of pages turning in a book upon a funeral pyre. Having heard this work in the mouth of the poet herself a few weeks ago, I continue to be stunned by the quality of it and the impact of it read aloud. I think works that deal with this kind of, or employ mechanisms that are so repetitive, that return and recurse and tread and retread in the ways that this one does, and builds that momentum over the course of the entire poem in the mouth of the reader, in the ear of the listener, really affect themselves especially well when spoken into the open air, I think. And so I find myself yet more affected being able to hear it once more.
The repetition of that word be feels so powerful to me. It operates so much like a pulse within the poem, a way of keeping alive. This poem's so concerned with being alive and being among the world.
It's interesting to me that late in the poem, it breaks that form. And we get a few lines, not only that don't start with be, but there are fewer periods. And it really felt like it built a bit of momentum, and there were both key concerns being expressed there in really, really beautiful language before we went back to the structure that was like the pulse.
One thing I love about this poem is how the repetition of the word be throughout operates similar to a pulse, and in that way seems to be keeping the poem alive, similarly to the concern of the poem about being alive and among the world.
And speaking to the ways by which that litany form does break down, where we are greeted with lines and moments that are not directive in the be this, be that. I think litany, like any other form, is especially useful for setting up a precedent and a standard by which the poem is teaches you to expect it to operate, and then breaks and subverts that standard and expectation to keep the mind of the person receiving it malleable, to open them, to put on a pedestal those things that might not conform to the standard that's been set for how you expect to read it. And I think this poem does that especially wonderfully. It also operates in that lovely tradition of poetry in which, much like the creative nonfiction piece we were talking about earlier, it speaks out from the page. It really lands and demands something of the readership. And so operating in a presumably second-person voice, be this, whether the poem is speaking to itself, whether the speaker is speaking to themselves or speaking out, it implicates the reader in a way that reminds me of that famous Rainer Maria Rilke poem, Archaic Torso of Apollo, that closes with, "You must change your life." And this one, I think, is more a more pragmatic, practical, direct way, framework by which one ought to change their life, or at least think critically about it.
From the fiction section of the 2018 fall-winter edition of the Colorado Review, I'll be reading a story called A Mouth is a House for Teeth by Michelle Ross. Before I read the excerpt, I just want to explain a little bit about the story, because it is really weird and it is amazing. I love this story. It's operating in kind of a strange space between a contemporary environment and a post-apocalyptic environment. So the premise is that we have a woman and her daughter in a house, and they follow protocol, which involves mostly not leaving the house. And periodically, the mother receives calls from her husband, who is doing some unknown dangerous work. And the world of the story is primarily inside, though there are fears about the outside. The section I'm going to read is from the middle of the story. In the fairy tales, the mother reads the girl before bed. The monsters are often mothers. Stepmothers, birth mothers, old hags, same difference. In the horror films the mother watches some evenings when the girl is asleep, the monsters are often children. Adopted children, biological children, little men who are mistaken for children. The girl often startles the mother. At night when she wakes from a nightmare and walks into the kitchen while the mother is baking, in the mornings when the mother is drinking coffee and doesn't realize the girl is up. The girl treads silently. No warning. Or like now, the mother walks right by the girl, curled up on the sofa, and the mother doesn't see the girl until the girl speaks. The mother screams. After the girl stops crying, she says, "Why did you scream?" The mother says, "I thought I was alone." The girl looks confused and also frightened. "Why would you think that?" The reason I wanted to read this section is that I found the relationship between the mother and her daughter to be fascinating. There's all the fear about the outside world and about having to follow protocol, but consistently in the story, it becomes clear that the mother fears her daughter. And the story operates in such a strange and warped world. And then I can't give away the ending because you have to read it. But these various tensions come to a head in a way that is both strange and extremely compelling and very affecting. I felt wrapped up in the story immediately and both delighted by the turns it was taking and very uneasy. And I think the mark of a good story is that it's able to surprise you, but also feel inevitable and deeply felt. And that's how I experienced this story.
One of the things I like especially about the way that you framed the piece and is shows through the segment that you chose to read is the way that fiction allows for external threats to be evidenced and voiced by internal ones. That those existential threats that might be physical, worldly, of the outside, articulate themselves cogently in the work, in the characters, and their personal spaces, in their own minds. And I think the ways that those two realms interact so wonderfully in this piece, speak to some of the things that fiction can do that other crafts and genres and forms of art can't. And I think that they're undertaken beautifully in this piece.
I agree. I think it's interesting, given what we said with regard to Erica Berry's piece, one major difference here is this very much feels like it's operating in a fictive space. Important to the concerns of the piece is the establishment of this strange and surreal and very tense world. And a non-fictive space for an essay can be tense, but in this case, it felt all-encompassing, the world that was made. Very quickly, you're in it, and it has its own rules, and your emotions follow the rules of the space that's been created.
One of the last things that I think is especially compelling about the piece is that its use of dialogue tags, its use of those kind of generalized, the girl, points of access to our characters allows them to have that kind of eerie distance that feels like a major engine of the work, that they're at once personalized, particularized in their own characters, but also generalized and made oblique. Thank you all for joining us for this exploration of the fall-winter 2018 edition of Colorado Review, and a special thanks to Susanna Lodrigal for offering your insights into our creative nonfiction and poetry selections.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been such a joy.
Thanks also to Stephanie Geschwind, editor-in-chief of Colorado Review, without whom this podcast would not be possible. Thanks to Arne Geschwind, composer and performer of the wonderful musical interludes used during the podcast. This has been Daniel Schoening.
And Evan Senny.
From all of us here at Colorado Review, we wish you happy holidays, and we hope that you join us again in January for our next edition of the Colorado Review podcast.